I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Civil War historian Alan Gelzo wrote in USA Today recently about the statues of Robert E. Lee that were being removed from cities and parks. He asked, why were these statues erected in the first place? After all, Lee was both a loser and a traitor, having fought against and surrendered to the U.S. government. Gelzo goes even further to ask if Lee was really the white supremacist that white supremacists claim he was. Alan Gelzo began writing his biography, Robert E. Lee, A Life, in 2014, before Charlottesville, when white supremacists protested the removal of a statue of Lee sitting on his horse that was erected in a popular downtown park. The protest turned violent, leading to the death of a counter-protester and the injury of many others. Gelzo writes the greatest blow to Lee's reputation would not come through a book, but through a riot. We ask Alan Gelzo to join us on Radio Times to help us understand Lee and what his life and legacy says about our country, about the Civil War. Lee called slavery immoral and yet fought to defend it. Alan Gelzo is senior research scholar in the Council of the Humanities at Princeton University, also director of the James Madison Program's Initiatives in Politics and Statesmanship. He won the Lincoln Prize 3 times and has been a guest on Radio Times talking about the Civil War. Alan Gelzo, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it is nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. You began this book 7 years ago. How different was the Lee that you began to investigate in 2014 and the Lee that you ended up with in 2021?
In 2014, I had just finished a big book on the Battle of Gettysburg. I was looking around for another Civil War subject. And in 2014, that's what Robert E. Lee was, another Civil War subject, a Civil War general, and a, I would say, reasonably important one to be the subject of a fairly healthy book. And then things changed over the succeeding years.
Would you say, I mean, you talk about B.C. before Charlottesville and I guess A.C. after Charlottesville. I mean, you see Charlottesville and what happened, gosh, in 2017 as a turning point for Robert E. Lee?
I think it was a dramatic turning point because the rioting that took place in Charlottesville, of course, boiled all around Lee's statue. And in some respects, Lee almost acquired a taint from that rioting, as though he'd gotten down off his horse and led some of the rioting himself. Then afterwards, the Lee statue was shrouded in black tarpaulins, and that only made the image of Robert E. Lee even more bizarre, because what does a statue of Lee look like when it's wrapped up in black plastic? So the story about Lee takes this very strange turn in 2017, and then it keeps taking more strange turns. He begins to acquire more kinds of unhappy resonance, and that culminates in 2020 and 2021 in movements to remove Lee statues, not only in Charlottesville, but on Monument Avenue in Richmond, where the biggest Lee statue of them all was located.
You also begin your book by saying, you know, how do you write about a traitor? So just to make sure our listeners understand, from your perspective, and I guess perspective from most everyone in this country, Robert E. Lee was a traitor.
The Constitution defines treason in very narrow but very specific terms, and that is giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States and making war against the United States. And if there's anyone whose actions conform to that, then it has to be said, yes, that's Robert E. Lee. He committed treason. And Marty, I don't use the term lightly. Some people will throw that around just as a term of disparagement. My father was a career Army. He took the oath. My son is a serving officer in the U.S. Army. He took the oath. I took the oath when I was a member of the National Council of the Humanities in 2006 to 2013. So I take that seriously. That's the oath that has run through the life of my family. Robert E. Lee raised his hand against that. I have no better word for it, legally, constitutionally, or otherwise, than simply treason.
He's a criminal. I mean, treason is a crime.
It is. It is, and it's punishable under terms of statutes that Congress passed very early in the life of the Republic, so that what he did, he knew he was doing. He knew the risks that he was taking. And I have to look at that and say that anyone who tries to avert their gaze from the fact that Robert E. Lee committed treason is really fooling themselves. Lee, in fact, was indicted for treason at the close of the war. He's never brought to trial because there's a number of complications, practical and otherwise, that enter into that. But he is indicted for treason. And he himself takes that very seriously.
And pardoned by President
Andrew Johnson.
Andrew Johnson at
it
the
was
time.
The blanket amnesty that Johnson issues on Christmas Day, 1868.
Well, let's go to the beginning. And I mean, it's always fascinating to understand someone's childhood and how what happened to them in childhood begins to shape them as an adult. And you look at his relationship with his father, who was a very well-known soldier, I guess, or military leader in the Revolutionary War.
Oh, his father was one of the heroes of the Revolution. Harry Lee was born of the extended Lee family in Virginia. He was part of the what you could call the cadet branch of the Lee family. It's not the mainstream of the Lees, like Richard Henry Lee or Francis Lightfoot Lee. Nevertheless, after he graduates from Princeton in 1771, he throws himself into the Revolution, and it is as a soldier that he makes a name that overshadows almost all the other Lees. He becomes a talented cavalry leader. He acquires the nickname Light Horse Harry, and he becomes part of that circle around George Washington, those young men whom Washington almost made into surrogate sons, like Marquis de Lafayette, Henry Lawrence, Alexander Hamilton. Lee excels that way. And when the Revolution is over, he enjoys all the glory and reputation that successful members of that Continental Army enjoyed. And alas, that was also the last moment that he enjoyed that kind of prominence.
Well, there were all sorts of financial problems that he got into, and eventually he abandoned the family. And you write about believing that that had an impact on Robert E. Lee himself as a young boy. He was, what, about 6 years old?
Yes. And it's one of those things where it can hardly help but have a traumatic impact on the life of someone who has not yet even entered adolescence. Light Horse Harry might have been a great commander of cavalry, but in every other respect, everything else he touched, well, it was like the Midas touch in reverse. Everything turned to lead. He married his cousin Matilda, so he became the master of Stratford Hall, the great Lee estate on the northern neck of Virginia. But he invested heavily in Western land, thinking that this was going to become a great development paradise, and it became anything but. He burned through Matilda's cash. When Matilda died, he remarried to a Virginia Carter. He burned through her cash. If Light Horse Harry was alive today, he'd be investing in ski resorts in Bangladesh. He just had
just
this
reckless?
Reckless, feckless, unwise, uncalculating, irrational, overly generous. Yeah, all of those terms apply. But it meant that he wound up in debtor's prison. And then he not only made financial mistakes, but he made political mistakes. Hmm. He was a Federalist. And in Virginia, that was not a particularly wise thing to do. He gets involved in a political riot in Baltimore where he's beaten within an inch of his life. And it's after those events that he simply leaves, takes off for the West Indies, and Robert never sees him again.
For the rest of his life.
For the rest of his life. He's essentially Robert E. Lee grows up fatherless.
So what do you think, and that's a lot for a young child to try to comprehend and process. So what do you think his father's actions and irresponsibilities had on this young boy?
I think it had two immediate impacts. One is almost impossible to measure because Robert Lee grows up always being introduced everywhere he goes as the son of Light Horse Harry. And yet, he never makes a single reference to his father in any of his voluminous letters.
I mean,
Robert E. Lee was a compulsive letter writer. There is only one of those letters that makes any reference to his father, and it's his application letter to West Point, when that connection would do him some practical good. Otherwise, Light Horse Harry Lee seems to have disappeared from any of his correspondence. He doesn't even visit his father's grave, which is on Cumberland Island, originally at least, in Cumberland Island off the the coast of Georgia until December of 1861. So there is something really missing in Robert E. Lee's life, and he has to deal with the fact that his father's famous, and yet personally he knows his father has failed him. The other thing that drives him to, I think, is a desire for perfection, a kind of redemptive perfectionism, that Robert E. Lee is going to redeem the reputation that his father fecklessly created. And I think that strain of perfectionism runs through Robert E. Lee's life from start to finish and also explains some of the more unappetizing incidents in Lee's life, because the downside of that perfectionism is a kind of temper, a kind of intolerance of faults and flaws in other people.
Perfectionism can show up in so many different ways. Does it make him kind of unknowable as someone who has spent 7 years trying to know this, understand this man?
He certainly is a difficult person to know, and even those who were his contemporaries described him as genteel, as polite, but also as aloof. One person even said he's not the sort of person that you'd want to put your arm around his shoulders like Joe Johnston. That kind of comparison tells you a great deal. He's affable. He is admirable in many ways. His conduct is spotless. But no one can find a way to get terribly close to the man. There's always that sense in which whatever gentility he has acts as a kind of shield that people cannot penetrate.
About a minute before our first break here, he does go to West Point, becomes an engineer, which is an interesting path to becoming then the general that he became. Do you think he had an engineer's perspective on war or tactics or fighting?
Well, he certainly had a bent for engineering, because he early manifested a talent for mathematics. Today, we'd call him a math nerd. And if you were going to be a math nerd, the profession you'd want to follow then would be engineering, and the school you'd want to go to would be West Point, because West Point is really the only engineering school in the country at that point. But it does intersect with that perfectionism, and you see in Robert E. Lee a kind of personality that is really happy with T-squares and formulas. I've looked through the notebook that he kept when he was the post engineer at Fort Hamilton. And it's a beautiful notebook. It's very precise. Everything is excruciatingly neat. And that neatness, I think, is a reflection of the man's personality and how he dealt with others.
That is our guest, Alan Gelso. He is a historian of the Civil War. In fact, has won the Lincoln Prize 3 times, and he's got a brand new book. It's called Robert E. Lee, A Life. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We want to hear from you. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can do it the old-fashioned way. Pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with award-winning Civil War historian Alan Gelso on the life of Robert E. Lee, why a general who committed treason, lost a war, has been celebrated for so long. His biography is titled Robert E. Lee, A Life. I should add that our guest is speaking at the Union League tonight. It is full, I am told, but you can find it by searching the Legacy Foundation on YouTube, and it all starts at 6:30. Let me just ask you a question or two about the Mexican-American War. Robert E. Lee does fight in that war. He writes to, I believe, his son, "You have no idea what a terrible sight a battlefield is." Help us understand what he was saying there. I mean, I can only imagine, especially, you know, in the middle of the 19th century.
Right. Robert E. Lee spends most of his career up until the outbreak of the war as an engineer. He's building fortifications. He's restoring the wharfage of St. Louis. He's building Fort Carroll in Baltimore Harbor. He mostly is specializing in coastal engineering. And then suddenly comes this war, and for soldiers in the U.S. Army, in the U.S. Army of that day, promotion was just glacially slow. So war is understood to be as an opportunity for glory and promotion. Mm-hmm. And Lee agitates to be dispatched to the scene of the fighting in Mexico. He's eventually attached to the staff of Winfield Scott. And Scott had a great eye for military talent. He sees right away that this man, Lee, is more than just an engineer who builds bridges and roads. Lee becomes his chief aide. And when Scott launches this extraordinary invasion of Mexico up from Veracruz to Mexico City, I mean, it's one of the great campaigns of the 19th century. Lee is the man who is more or less in charge of his reconnaissance, of placing units, of being the extension of Winfield Scott. But it's a very jarring experience because he spent so many years as an engineer simply building things. And now he's on the field of battle and he's seeing what battle does. And in the 19th century, what battle does to people is not pretty to watch. It is nothing like what people see in movies or on television. It is mangling. It is horrible in its prospect. It looks bad. It smells worse. Mm. It is almost physically revolting. And that's Lee's first experience of war. He's not one of these people who wants to jump up and down and rejoice in killing. He's almost put off by what the experience of real combat is. And that's what is contained in that letter he writes to his son and in a similar letter that he writes to his wife.
Well, let me ask you about Robert E. Lee and slavery. You quote him, and I will quote him, "In this enlightened age, there are a few, I believe, but will acknowledge that slavery as an institution is a moral and a political evil in any country." He goes on from there. Help us understand then how he viewed slavery.
Robert E. Lee had in some ways almost nothing more than a tangential connection to slavery. He owned one slave family, but that was a family he inherited from his mother, from his mother's estate. He never actually owned other slaves in his own name, which sounds like, oh, we're talking about someone who is not deeply involved in slavery. Well, no, because he marries Mary Anna Randolph Custis, who is the only child of George Washington Parke Custis and his wife, and that's one of the great families of Virginia. I mean, George Washington Parke Custis is the step-grandson of Washington, and he owns this palatial estate on the Potomac overlooking the Capitol, which he named Arlington. You know, today that's Arlington National mm-hmm. Cemetery. There were 190 slaves owned by the Custises, and that meant that although Robert E. Lee doesn't actually own slaves, he benefits from the slave system. There are Custis slaves who will wait on him day and night, take care of the family, do everything that would make Robert E. Lee perfectly in harmony and in company with anyone who was a plantation slaveholder.
In fact, you write that his quote-unquote indifference to slavery, while not being, you know, overtly pro-slavery, is really almost the next thing.
When Robert E. Lee talks about slavery being a moral and political evil in any country, he means it. I think he's being very straightforward and very sincere that way. The problem is that sincerity doesn't take you a whole lot down the road of practicality. And it was very easy, not just for Lee, but for a lot of well-intentioned Virginians and other people of the Upper South, you know, Kentucky, places where slavery was starting to lose its economic hold. It was very easy for them to say, we deplore slavery, but, and the but would be, we don't know what to do next, and maybe we don't want to think about what to do next. So it was possible for Lee and many people like him to look at slavery and say, this is wrong, it's morally wrong, we know it's a violation of natural law, natural rights, to look at that and then to look away. Mm. And that is what Lee does.
And his view of enslaved people, I mean, is horrifying. I mean, seeing them as lesser humans.
Yes, he is a white supremacist in an age when, in the South at least, certainly, white supremacy was simply taken for granted. He will take what we might call a more professional viewpoint of things, because he's not really in charge of slaves at Arlington until the death of his father-in-law in 1857. And then he does give direction to Arlington, but he gives it the kind of direction an engineer would. He wants to put this on a professional basis. That was not the viewpoint shared by the enslaved people at Arlington, because they understood that Robert E. Lee's father-in-law's will had emancipated them. And technically it had, because old George Washington Parke Custis had put a provision into his will that his slaves would have to be emancipated within 5 years. You see, Custis is another one of these people, like Robert E. Lee, who will tell you, frankly, slavery is wrong, but I'm not going to do anything about it that's going to inconvenience me. I will emancipate the slaves, but after I'm dead. That happened over and over and over again. And Lee, as the executor of his father-in-law's estate, has to take charge of the slave population. And as an engineer, he goes at the job as you might expect an engineer would go at it. That was not the viewpoint of the slaves. They thought that they had been emancipated at the time of Custis's death. And that creates probably one of the most horrifying situations in Lee's life.
Well, how did he? I mean, there's a scene in here where he whips, I mean, brutally beats a slave who has run away.
There were actually three slaves who run away from the Arlington plantation. They're convinced that old Custis's will freed them. They run away. They're apprehended in Westminster, Maryland, and brought back to Arlington. And when Lee quizzes them, why did you run away? Their response is, because we considered ourselves to be as free as you are. That ignites a torch in Lee, because these slaves were obstructing the path of the realization of his executorship of Custis's will.
And that's property, right?
And their property. And what's more, they're supposed to generate legacies for Robert E. Lee's children. That was part of the will. So they, when they give this kind of answer to him, that sets him off. He demands the overseer at Arlington whip these slaves. The overseer refuses. He turns then to the bailiff who brought the slaves back from Westminster, Maryland, and he instructs the bailiff, lay it on. He's going to teach them a lesson. And at least one account claims that Lee took the whip himself and laid the stripes on with his own hand. What's curious here is afterwards, Lee reflects on this very tangentially, but it's almost as though he can't believe that he lost control the way he did. He writes to his oldest son, Custis, and he says, you've read in the papers, because this story got into the New York Tribune, you've read in the papers about what happened. Your grandfather has left me an unpleasant legacy. He didn't want to talk about it. It had deeply embarrassed him. And I think it embarrassed him partly because of he knew what he had done was cruelty. But even more, it embarrassed him because that sense of perfect self-control had escaped him at that moment.
He had lost his...
He had become like Light Horse Harry, the very thing he wanted to avoid all through his life.
I mean, it's interesting is the wrong word, but, you know, it's sort of horrifying that and as you write about Robert E. Lee, that he can be in such, I mean, to use a very psychological word, in such denial.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to be sort of saying this is an immoral institution and yet to own people and, in this case, obviously mistreat them terribly.
But do we not do things like that all the time?
We do.
Is this not an aspect of human psychology? When we look at problems and we know that they're wrong and then we look away, that dilemma is a philosophical dilemma as old as the Stoics, even as old as Plato.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We got a lot of people that want to join us. Talking with Alan Gelzo. He's a historian of the American Civil War, and he's got a new book. It's titled Robert E. Lee, A Life. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Before I get to some of the comments here, just to help us understand, he actually has a choice on which side of the war to fight. He obviously chooses the South. What is the back and forth that he is weighing?
It's a step by step. He, at that particular time, this is April of 1861, Fort Sumter has been fired upon, and the federal government is going to have to respond to this. He is, at that moment, technically the colonel of the 1st United States Cavalry. He had been lieutenant colonel of the 2nd, but he's now promoted. He's colonel of the 1st United States Cavalry. And because he is the favored son, so to speak, of Winfield Scott, Scott advises Lincoln that command of the federal field armies should be turned over to Robert E. Lee. Scott's too old to do it himself, so he wants Lee to do it. Lincoln has a political operative, Francis Preston Blair, one of the old Washington hands in Washington politics, bring Lee to his home. Actually, it's his son, it's Blair's son's home. It's Blair House.
Oh, Blair House in D.C.?
Exactly, right on Pennsylvania Avenue. And Francis Preston Blair brings Lee there and makes the offer of command. Lee turns him down. Lee says, I can't draw my sword against my native state, Virginia. He does say it's not because of slavery. He said if it was a question of slavery, I would cheerfully free every slave in the South to avoid war.
Do you believe him?
It's not only said by Lee, but Francis Preston Blair and Montgomery Blair in separate accounts afterwards confirmed that.
Right. That he said that.
That he said that.
Right. Whether he believed it or not.
Whether he believed it or not, but he certainly said it in such a way that both of the Blairs believed it. He then goes and has a very painful interview with General Scott, goes home, writes out a letter of resignation from the U.S. Army. So there's two decisions right there. He's not going to take command of federal forces. He's going to resign from the U.S. Army. Now, at that point, Marty, he could have simply said, I'm washing my hands of this. I'm going to stay neutral in whatever conflict emerges. He doesn't, because right on the heels of that, representatives from the governor of Virginia show up, and they persuade him to go to Richmond, and there he's offered command of the Virginia State Forces, which he accepts. That's the third step in this decision. And each one of these is a separate decision.
Yeah.
Each one of these is incremental. He takes one step, and he finds himself compelled to take the next, and the next, and the next. And then, by the end of April 1861, he finds himself really fighting against the authority of the federal government that he had earlier in his career sworn to uphold.
And fight to defend slavery.
That's what it really amounts to, because what else is the Confederacy but a movement for the defense of slavery? Now, I know, and I'm sure you have heard and many of your listeners have heard, people say, oh, no, no, the Confederacy was about this, the Confederacy was about that, it was about states' rights, it was about tariffs. That has no substance whatsoever. The fundamental reason that the Confederate states secede from the Union, and they say this in their secession ordinances, is for the protection of slavery. And that is where you find Robert E. Lee now in this step-by-step process as the man who is going to become the chief defender of the slave system, a slave system which all through the war he will tell his federal Confederates that they have to get rid of because it's going to be a millstone around the Confederacy's neck.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from George, speaking to what you were just talking about, was the root of the Civil War based more on economics of the time? Was Lee fighting more for the independent economic prosperity of the South rather than upholding slavery? And you say in the final analysis, the Civil War was about upholding slavery.
If you take slavery out of the equation, there is no Civil War. You know, there may be between different sections of the country economic rivalry. Certainly there was between New England and the Northwest and the Northwest and the Southwest and the Southwest and the Gulf states. But that is not going to give us civil war. Right. What really gives us civil war is slavery. And as many times as I hear from people who want to argue otherwise, that is the unavoidable fact of the American Civil War. it was fought over slavery.
Here's a related question from Thomas. What about Southern sensibility of honor and why Lee chose to fight for Virginia, his family, and the Confederacy? And as you write in this book, in many ways, he did think he was fighting for Virginia and his own property in many ways.
Well, here's one of the curious things. Lee says repeatedly, it almost becomes his mantra, I cannot draw my sword against my native state. And the funny thing is that in some respects, he's really not much of a Virginian. I mean, he's born on the Northern Neck, but the family moves to Alexandria when he's a boy, when he's 8 years old. And Alexandria was not part of Virginia then. It was part of the District of Columbia. And he grows up there as part of the District of Columbia. He then goes to West Point, New York. He is then assigned his first posting to Georgia. He then serves in St. Louis. He serves in Baltimore. He's back to New York for service at Fort Hamilton and then as superintendent of West Point and then Texas. The man actually spent a comparatively small amount of his life in Virginia. If you toed up the number of years in various places, he actually spent more years in New York than he spent in Virginia. So when he talks about Virginia, is he really talking about this mysterious soil of the Old Dominion? I don't think so. I think what he's talking about is, first of all, the vast network of relatives that he had in Virginia. Carter relatives, Lee relatives. When Lee was growing up in Alexandria, I often say that if he had thrown a brick down a street in Alexandria, he would have hit a relative.
Wow.
He had something like 80 first cousins. That network of relatives was what comforted and secured his family after Light Horse Harry left the family. They were the ones who stepped up and supported Anne Carter Lee and her progeny. So he owes Virginia, but it's a Virginia of family connections.
And that is Alan Gelso. We're talking about the life of Robert E. Lee. He's just written a biography of Lee. And you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Alan Gelso. He is Senior Research Scholar in the Council of the Humanities at Princeton University, Director of the James Madison Program's Initiative in Politics and Statesmanship. Just wrote a book called Robert E. Lee, A Life. He has won the Lincoln Prize 3 times, and we are talking about the life of Robert E. Lee. Well, let's talk about him as a military commander. You take him a bit off his pedestal. I think people, whether you agreed with his philosophy and his racial thinking, I think a lot of people felt like, well, at least on the battlefield, he was a pretty skilled commander. You raised some questions about that.
Well, there's 3 ways.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Your mic is on now. Yeah, go ahead.
Very good.
That's okay.
There's 3 ways of evaluating a major military commanding figure. One is to think of this individual as a strategic thinker, someone who has the big picture, so to speak. Another is a tactical thinker, someone who knows how to read a battlefield and who performs in a very effective fashion that way. And then a military commander should be evaluated as a logistical or operational leader. In other words, are they keeping the troops supplied? Are they keeping their troops moving? Do they know how to interact and interface with the civilian sector? Those are 3 very important categories of evaluation. And if you look at Robert E. Lee, certainly I think he gets 5 stars in the strategic aspect because few Confederates saw as clearly as Lee saw that in the long run, the Confederacy could not win a war with the North. You might think of it in terms of a heavyweight bout. He understood that the Confederacy couldn't last 15 rounds. It just simply didn't have the resources compared to the North. And he says this very early on.
So it had to, if you're going to win, you got to do it quickly.
Exactly. You've got to score a surprise knockout in the first or the second round. And I use that analogy because my grandfather was a boxer.
Oh,
so I grew up hearing all about
that.
Lee sees that that's what's going to happen for the Confederacy. So his solution is not go on the defensive, not try to protect the Southern heartland, but rather to launch these invasions. And he begins thinking about launching invasions of the North as early as April of 1862. He does this in the fall of 62 in the Maryland campaign, does it again in the campaign that culminates at Gettysburg, and is ready to do it again in 1864, except that Ulysses Grant gets in his way. He understood that the way to win the war was to get loose on Northern soil, either win a big battle on Northern soil or else just run around unopposed. Either way, what that would do would be to depress the political morale of the North. And when the political will of the North diminished for fighting this war, then pressure would be put on the Lincoln administration to open negotiations. And once negotiations began, they weren't going back to shooting. That would virtually assure the independence of the Confederacy. So strategically, he has the right view of things.
Doesn't work, though.
Well, long term, no, but that was because he had a pretty formidable opponent strategically in Ulysses Grant. Tactically, Lee does not like to take tactical charge on the battlefield. As he explained to a Prussian military observer, what he preferred to do was to make sure he got all of his army to a particular place, and then he let talented subordinates take over the tactical responsibility, which was fine so long as he had talented subordinates who could do that, people like Stonewall Jackson, people like James Longstreet. Once he loses them, as he loses Jackson in 1863, Longstreet in 1864, after that, he has to pick up tactical charge because he doesn't have any other talent to turn to. And he's clearly very uncomfortable doing that. Logistically, he probably gets the lowest grade because he had learned very early on, don't challenge the political people. Don't challenge the civilian authorities. That means he won't go to bat when the civilian authorities are doing an incompetent job of supplying his armies. He should have confronted the politicians about the need for supplying his army. And he doesn't do it because he's unwilling to pick a fight with the politicians.
Was there any way, do you think, that Lee could have won the war? Or was it just, it was a lost cause from the get-go?
He came close.
Yeah.
He came close. If he had succeeded at Gettysburg, then it's entirely possible that the Federal Army of the Potomac might simply have fell apart, like Napoleon's after Waterloo. And if that was the case, then Lee would have had an open pathway to Baltimore, Washington, Philadelphia. And what's more, there were two major governor's races taking place in the fall of 1863, Pennsylvania and Ohio. The Lincoln administration had already lost governor's races in New York and New Jersey the previous fall. If Northern political opinion had gone down so far that they elected anti-Lincoln governors in Pennsylvania and Ohio as well, that's the central core of the North. If those governors had folded their arms and said, we're not cooperating anymore with the Lincoln administration, the Lincoln administration would have had only two choices, resignation or open negotiations with the Confederacy. And what happened at Gettysburg was, in truth, a close-run thing. Lee came very, very close to winning that battle.
And you have written books about that.
At great length.
At great length, exactly. In fact, you were a guest on Radio Times talking about that. Let me just make I'm looking at the clock here because I do want to talk about where things stand with Robert E. Lee today. But there are a couple of questions about what he did as an educator. He was the founder of Washington College or Washington University, Washington and Lee.
Well, he's not the founder, but he is, in some senses, the second refounder. When the war is over, of course, the big question is going to be, what is Lee going to do?
Right.
And that's complicated by the indictment for treason that is handed down. He's basically a man with a sword over his head. He wants to get as far away from Washington and Washington politics as possible, out of sight, out of mind. He gets this offer out of the blue from Washington College, this little school in the upper reaches of the Shenandoah, which had been little more than a kind of classical academy for the Scots-Irish of the Upper Valley. And he accepts. He accepts the presidency. I think part of it is because he really wants to get away from Washington. And he becomes a fabulous success as the president of a college. The last thing in the world you would have expected from Robert E. Lee. But he builds up the student body, builds up the faculty, builds up the endowment, and in many respects, the institution which today is Washington and Lee University really owes its life to the 5 years that Robert E. Lee was its president.
So here's a tweet from Jonathan. My understanding of Lee's life is that he somewhat turned around and became president of Washington College University. So is he a hero? Should we see him that way? And did he turn his life around?
Yes and no. He doesn't turn his life around on the subject of race. He continues to be a white supremacist. And while he's not going to regret the end of slavery, and he says that pretty explicitly, he also is not going to take any steps that will promote racial equality, especially civil equality. It's not that he's going to make a fuss about things, and he certainly goes out of his way to discourage the Ku Klux Klan in his region. When students at Washington College start misbehaving and harassing the freed people in the Lexington area, especially the freedmen's schools, Lee rebukes them, in some cases expels students who are connected with that. Yet at the same time, he makes no step whatsoever to integrate Washington College. Mm-hmm. It remains very much a school for what was known as General Lee's boys. And his own comments about black people are distancing, if not outright demeaning. You cannot trust black people, he said, because black people have this long history of injury, and they nurse that injury, and they will plot your ill fate. They will do nothing to help you. So there should really be two spheres. One sphere for white people, one sphere for black people, and they can somehow get along happily in their separate spheres. That's his view of things.
Did he fear when there was slavery, a slave rebellion or uprising? Obviously for the mistreatment of these of so many people.
Every Southerner was terrified at the prospect of slave uprisings. The vision of Nat Turner haunted every Southern slave owner's nighttime dreams. And Lee himself had had some connection with the Turner uprising because he had been stationed at Fortress Monroe when the Turner uprising took place. Now, he downplays the threat. Of course, he always downplayed threats. But every Southerner had to cope with the thought that the next night might bring another Nat Turner. Lee, in the post-war years, will not function on the basis of terror, but he will function on the basis of racial distaste. And it simply cannot be erased from him. So I think that qualifies any sense in which we want to talk about the man as a hero. He could have done better. He simply, positively could have done better. Now, on the other hand, he also could have done a lot worse.
Right.
Now, that may not be saying a whole lot, but it is true. He could have done a lot worse than he did. He could have led resistance to Reconstruction. He could have become a spearhead for various white supremacist resistance groups, and he declines to do that. So he's not as good as he should have been, not as bad as he could have been. Does that put him in the category of hero? Well, maybe not quite.
Well, let's talk about the statues. Some are being taken down. We began the show talking about Richmond and also Charleston, the statues of Robert E. Lee being taken down. Do you have a position on that? What do we do about this man?
Marty, I'm at sixes and sevens about Lee statues because the Yankee in me, as a Philadelphia boy, as a Pennsylvanian, scratches the head and wonders, why do we put statues up in the first place to people who have committed treason? Why do you do that? That doesn't seem to be logical, in at least in my experience. Growing up in Philadelphia, I learned my Civil War, so to speak, at my grandmother's knee. And she had been a schoolgirl here in Philadelphia at the George Clymer School. And as a schoolgirl, those old veterans of the Union Army would come every Decoration Day. That's what they called Memorial Day then. And they'd come to her school, and they'd talk about the real reason for the Civil War. And their message was always, it's not what those Johnny Rebs have been saying.
Yeah.
So I learned the Union cause very early on, and it's something of a mystery to me. Why do you put up statues to people who fought against that? Yet at the same time, the statues themselves have interesting histories and interesting memories attached to them. For instance, there's a great equestrian statue of Robert E. Lee on the Gettysburg battlefield. And it shows Lee atop the monument to the Virginia soldiers who fought at Gettysburg. And it's a grand monument. But when it was dedicated in 1917, there were two dedication speeches. One was given by the governor of Virginia, and it was all about how Robert E. Lee is teaching us to face to the future. We need to put the Confederacy behind us. We need to put the past behind us. We have a new role in the world that we're about to embark upon, and Lee shows us the way of reconciliation. The next person to get up and deliver a dedication speech was a Confederate veteran who went on a ceaseless rant about white supremacy, the inferiority of black people, and how Robert E. Lee tells us the real message about it.
Wow.
Now, to whom then does the statue belong, the first dedication or the second dedication?
I mean, I like to think in the United States of America, it's the first dedication, isn't it?
Yeah, I would like to think so, too. And that's also part of the irony about the Charlottesville statue. When the Charlottesville statue was dedicated in 1926, the dedication speech was delivered by Maury Jones, who was the son of a Lee biographer. Maury Jones was a Baptist minister who had stood up against the Klan, stood up against segregation. When he gives his dedication speech, it's all about how this statue of Lee shows us to put the Southern past behind us and to look forward the way this statue is looking forward to a new unified and reconciled nation. So what are the meanings that we impute to statues? They're diverse. They change over time. We were talking before we went on the air about visiting Gettysburg and all the statues that are there. Statues change. If you look at especially those statues that Union veterans put up on the Gettysburg battlefield in the years after the war, those were really put up as memorials, and they were memorials to the righteousness of the Union cause. And then a couple of generations go by, and they really become monuments. You know, great-grandfather fought in the 42nd New York. Ah, that's what that's about. And then a couple of more generations go by, and they really become just simply placeholders. Tourists go by and say, oh, that monument tells us where the 42nd New York stood at the battlefield. Monuments change. Meanings change with them. And we need to also factor the ways in which those meanings have changed as we deal with what kind of statues we want to put up and what kind of statues we want to take down. It's a very complex question.
It is, and we have no time to answer that. I'm looking at the clock here. But for some people, you know, they look at Robert E. Lee, and it is a symbol of the lost cause.
Yeah.
And the idea of, you know, the glory of the South and what the South fought for. I mean, it seems to me we have to figure out how to reject that.
We do, and we also have to do that in the context of other kinds of monumentation. How do we remember our past? Not just Robert E. Lee, but in what kind of balanced way, what kind of complicated way do we remember our past? You know, there's a monument out in California to the Donner Party. And these were the people that had to resort to cannibalism in the trapped in the snows. Does that monument promote cannibalism? We would say no. But that's also part of the complexity of the meaning of monuments and statues. They are our history, but our history should be as complicated as the people those statues remember.
Well, we got to leave it there. Alan Gelzo, thank you for joining us
today
on Radio
Marty.
Times. And again, he's got a new book. It's called Robert E. Lee, A Life. And Alan Gelzo is Senior Research Scholar in the Council of the Humanities at Princeton University. Go to WHYY.org and you can look for Radio Times under Programs. You can always download a podcast of our show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you for joining us.